one fellow traveller, a male fag-hag, an observer in the midst of sympathetic strangers. It was thrilling, but also a way of playing it safe. Perhaps that was why I was attracted to Japan, a society to which a foreigner could never belong, even if he wanted to. Donald was dressed like a conventional middle-class American. Light blue jacket, grey shirt, a knitted maroon tie, big black Florsheim shoes. He looked young for his age, which would have been around 53. Pink cheeks, brownish hair, large white hands, a boyish Midwestern face that slightly resembled that of Alfred Kinsey, the famous sexologist. The range of his conversation was astonishing. Japanese movie world gossip, Arnold Schoenberg's expressionist songs, Ozu Yasujiro's films compared to Kurosawa Akira's, Jane Austen's late novels. But his main subject, especially when he was addressing me as the newcomer, was the way foreigners lived in Japan. He pointed out the pitfalls that many gaijin stumbled into, namely the speed with which infatuation could change into disenchantment or even peevish resentment, as though Japan were to blame for personal disillusion. He mentioned the Seidensticker syndrome, named after his friend, the scholar Edward Seidensticker. Ed habitually spent half the year in Japan. When he arrived in Tokyo, he was ready to kiss the ground. Everything was wonderful. And then, once he'd more or less settled down, he began to get more and more irritated by these people, until after 6 months he was quite ready to go home. The great mistake, Donald told me, was to think that you could ever be treated in the same way as a Japanese. People would be polite, even warm. Profound friendships with the Japanese were perfectly possible. But you would never be one of them. You would always be an outside person, the literal meaning of gaijin. Those foreigners who were foolish enough to resent this could easily develop a full-blown case of gaijinitis, in which every sign of special treatment, whether deferential or contemptuous, was seen as a bitter blow to their amour propre. He, Donald, felt entirely at ease as an outsider. The great thing about Japan, he said, was that one was left alone. To be Japanese in Japan was to be caught in an almost intolerable web of rules and obligations. But the gaijin was exempt from all that. He could observe life with serene detachment, not being bound to anything or anyone. In Japan, Donald felt utterly, radically free. For a man of Donald's inclinations, this would clearly have been impossible in Lima, Ohio, where he grew up dreaming of escape. But even in New York, where he lived in the late 1960s as the curator of film at the Museum of Modern Art, he still felt constrained. So he came back to Japan just a few years before I met him, not exactly as a sexual exile, but as a man who was convinced that when he first arrived in Japan in the late 1940s, he had glimpsed his private Arcadia, a country where he would never be judged for his desires. "You know," he said, before we parted company at the Hongo subway station, "you have to be a romantic to live in Japan. A person who feels complete, who does not question who he is or his place in the world, will dislike it here. To be constantly exposed to such a radically different culture becomes unbearable. But to a romantic, open to other ways of being, Japan is full of wonders. Not that you'll ever belong here, but that will set you free, and freedom is better than belonging. You see, here you can make yourself into anything you want to be." I'm not sure I knew exactly what he meant by this. Much later, he would explain his allegiance to Sartre's existential views on the need to create your own life as an act of will to be authentic. But the image of Donald that night, standing on the opposite station platform with his pink cheeks and big black shoes, unassailable in the midst of crowds of Japanese, has stayed with me. Perhaps I felt liberated too. What to make of myself was the question. Chapter 3. I never thought I could be Japanese, nor did I wish to be. But I suppose I was a romantic in Richie's sense of the word. I was open to change. This meant, in the early stages of my life in Japan, almost total immersion. The fact that I was living with a Japanese woman in a middle-class suburb on the Seibu-Shinjuku commuter line, surrounded by noodle shops, Shinto shrines, public bathhouses, and old wooden houses with bonsai gardens helped. You could still hear some of the traditional sounds of urban Japanese life then. The plaintive cry, a bit like a muezzin calling Muslims to prayer, of the sweet potato vendors, the dry crack of wooden clappers struck at night by the neighborhood fire watchmen, the foghorn sounds of the tofu sellers, the haunting drone of a bronze bell from a local temple. Less traditional were the jingles and recorded messages from political candidates waving their white-gloved hands from passing cars, even if the streets were empty and there was no one to wave back. Then there were the scurrying feet of the family health merchants, after they had deposited a basket filled with condoms at the door to be returned if not required. Visiting Sumia's family home in Gifu, a provincial town about 160 miles to the west of Tokyo, meant an even deeper immersion into traditional Japanese life. Tani-san, her father, a war veteran who'd served in the Imperial Japanese Army in China, was a sign painter. As a member of the artisan class, he took pride in his independence and his artistic skill. His way of life was more old-fashioned and relaxed than that of most so-called salarymen, the white-collar army of grey-suited strap-hangers commuting every day to their offices from tiny apartments in the outer suburbs. More often than not, salarymen in the 1970s had left the traditional duties of communal living with extended families behind. The modern nuclear family was seen as a kind of liberation, even if it resulted in lonely isolation, especially for the wives, waiting up at night for their husbands to stagger home from social functions imposed on the lower-ranking office workers. Independent craftsmen were different. Three generations of Tanis lived in a cozy two-story wooden house in an old part of town, smelling of fresh tatami mats, incense from the local temple, and dodgy drains. Japan is now famous for its luxurious toilets, with electric heated seats, automatic flush, different varieties of spray and tinkling music. But in his masterful essay In Praise of Shadows, the novelist Tanizaki Junichiro extolled the virtues of the traditional, dimly lit, wooden Japanese toilet, where one contemplated the beauties of nature while squatting over a hole in the ground with boughs of cedar at the bottom to sweeten the smell. Such toilets barely exist anymore. The Tanis still had one, even though the beauties of nature were not in sight. Night soil collectors would come to the house every so often to pick up the waste to fertilize the fields outside town. The family also shared a communal bathtub of fragrant hinoki wood. Seniority dictated the order of bathing. As soap was used only outside the tub, the water remained relatively clean even for the last one to use it. If one happened upon a person emerging from the bathroom without any clothes on, grandmother say, one pretended not to have seen her. Sometimes, for sheer pleasure, we'd go to the local public bathhouse, the Sento, with its tiled walls decorated with vistas of Mount Fuji, where we gossiped with the neighbors while politely splashing one another's backs from small bamboo buckets. I don't wish to idealize the life of the Tanis. Their extended family was as prone to bitter rows and irreconcilable feuds as any other. And the way the family was bossed around by the authoritarian grandfather, a former railway official, before he died not long after my arrival, made the decision of salarymen's wives to plump for splendid isolation in high-rise apartments more understandable. But there was a generosity of spirit in the Tani household, a broad-mindedness that was often lacking in more prosperous families, where social face had to be more carefully guarded. One generational clash that would later explode in permanent estrangement between father and eldest son concerned the different attitudes toward their advertising business. The son, named Kazuo, regarded his father's artisanal pride in hand-painted shop signs or movie billboards, carefully copied from film stills, as so much waste of time. He preferred to use plastic models or other technological shortcuts, which he regarded not without reason as cheaper and more with the times. He saw himself not as a craftsman, but as a modern businessman. But this rift had not yet erupted when I first stayed with the Tanis. The workshop was built as an extension of the main family room, where the television was permanently switched on, and we ate our meals. The parents and grandmother slept there too, in bedding rolled out on the tatami floor at night. The rest of us slept on the first floor, near the Buddhist altar, where grandmother prayed every morning to the black-and-white photograph of her late husband, placed in the midst of offerings of fruit and rice cakes. The workshop was filled with cans of paint, slabs of hardboard and movie posters. Since the main commercial fare in the mid-1970s consisted of a heavy diet of soft porn films produced by the Nikatsu Movie Studio, the family took its simple dinners of fish, rice, and miso soup, surrounded by lurid images of helpless young housewives trussed up in ropes by gangsters in leather jackets and sunglasses. After dinner, before I had my bath, Kazuo would often take me to the local Nikatsu movie theater, where he enjoyed free access to see some of these films. They were much more interesting than the student movies I had seen, which were clearly modeled after them. Indeed, they were more interesting than any porn film I'd ever seen in the West, which were mostly coarse, leering, and unimaginative. A discussion of 70s culture in Japan would be incomplete without reference to roman porno, or porno romance, the official name of this specific genre, which attracted some of the most talented young directors. Forget about Ozu and Kurosawa, I was frequently told by fellow students at the Nichidai Film School. Go and see Kumashiro Tatsumi's movies, featuring Ichijo Sayuri, the most popular roman porno star at the time. Ichijo had had a distinguished career as a stripper in Osaka. Many of the pictures she starred in had inventive plots and were technically accomplished, even innovative. This was not just because it was getting harder for young talent to break into the fast-crumbling studio system. Porno was now the favored genre of leftists who were disillusioned by the failure of political activism in the 60s. Japan had effectively been a one-party state for several decades, ruled by the conservative liberal Democrats, overseen by an entrenched bureaucracy, and manipulated by industrial combines, agricultural lobbies, and American security interests. After more than 10 years of student protest, the militant left had come apart in ultra-violent factions like the Japanese Red Army, exploding in spectacular and often suicidal acts of terrorism. Red Army fighters ended up dead or in places like Pyongyang and Beirut, while some of their cinematic fellow travelers drifted into porno. Thwarted political subversion had morphed into socio-erotic rebellion. This resulted in at least one genuine masterpiece. Oshima Nagisa released his hardcore sex film In the Realm of the Senses in 1976. His earlier movies had been highly political, about discrimination against Koreans, student activism, crime as a form of social protest, or oppression in the slums of Osaka. Now he would see how far he could push freedom of expression by making a pornographic art film. In the Realm of the Senses was a huge succeda scandal, based on a true story set in the 1920s. The film depicted a passionate love affair between a former prostitute named Abe Sada and a restaurant owner named Kichizo, which ended in his violent death after a bout of rough sex. The rough sex included Sada's attempts to heighten her lover's ecstasy by almost strangling him with the sash of her kimono, a game that became less and less playful as time went on until it proved to be fatal. In a fit of madness, Sada cut off the main object of her desire, including the testicles, and stuffed it into her purse. No filmmaker had ever pulled off anything like this before. The movie was both hardcore and tender, a cinematic blow for sexual freedom, especially for women. Sada, the prostitute, played by Matsuda Eiko, a former actress in Teruyama Shuji's Tenjin Sajiki, is not a helpless object of male lust, but an equal partner in an erotic obsession, which did not prevent Matsuda's career from sinking into oblivion, even opprobrium, while her male counterpart, Fuji Tatsuya, became a star. After the film was first shown at the Cannes Film Festival, I went to see Teruyama Shuji at the Tenjo Sajiki headquarters in Shibuya, a fizzy area in the west of Tokyo, where he lived in a small apartment, allegedly with his mother. The theatrical wizard's own sexuality was a bit of a mystery. He had a history of being reprimanded by the local police for peeping into people's bedrooms. Teriyama had seen Oshima's movie at Cannes. His mouth tightened when I asked him about it. "Not very interesting at all," he said. "Most Roman porno films are much better." I suspected that envy had affected his usually sound judgment. Oshima's movie provoked a notorious obscenity trial in Japan. Not against the film itself, which couldn't be released in its original form, but against the publication of the script illustrated by photographic stills. Oshima's wonderful defense was, "So what's wrong with obscenity?" He was acquitted. Alas, most Japanese never had the chance to judge for themselves. By the time the movie came to Tokyo, the print had been so badly mutilated by the censors, who were obliged to eliminate every sign of human genitals with razor blades and Vaseline, that Oshima's masterpiece was unwatchable. Quite why people were not allowed to see genitals on the screen, even though mixed bathing in public hot springs was still relatively common in rural areas, is a bit of a mystery. Probably this had something to do with the tug of war that went back centuries between the authorities insisting on public order and social control, and unruly artists insisting on subverting it. Certainly Puritanism, of the Christian kind, is not a part of Japanese tradition. Kazuo had no doubt that taking me to the porno theatre after dinner was a fitting entertainment. There was no shame attached to it, any more than that anyone felt embarrassed about sharing a family bath. But again, Sumie's was an old-fashioned household. Perhaps censorious attitudes were more prevalent among the higher, more westernized classes. I believe this is what Donald Ritchie was getting at when he stressed what he called the innocence of the Japanese. "The Japanese" was still a phrase that was used readily by men of Ritchie's generation. Soon after meeting him for dinner with John Roderick, Donald became my mentor on things concerning the Japanese. He was the sensei. I would be his disciple or deshi. We had regular lunches near a publisher's office in Roppongi where he did editing work in the afternoons and talked about the Japanese. By innocence, I think Donald meant the lack of any consciousness of original sin in the Christian sense. Sexual behavior was kept in check by propriety, not by religious prescriptions or threats of metaphysical doom. And propriety was something that concerned the guardians of social order, hence their reaction to Oshima's film. Roman porno, whose clever directors found ever more ingenious ways to avoid the censor's razor blades, was far less radical than Oshima's film, but breathed the same imaginative spirit of freedom. Since the privileged gaijin was exempted from many Japanese proprieties, Japan in the 1940s must have seemed like paradise to a young American raised in small-town Ohio. Donald never built a private Arcadia in the way others like John Roderick had done. No beautiful old house filled with antique screens. He did for a while live in such a house belonging to another sexual exile, an American art book publisher named Meredith Tex Weatherby, whose late boyfriend had taken a famous photograph of Mishima posing in nothing but a loincloth in the snow-covered garden and brandishing a samurai sword. There were many stories of wild times back in the day. I only remember Tex in his later years, a large, shambling man peering over his bifocals while he was doing needlepoint. Despite living in Weatherby's house for some time, Donald did not much like the company of gay men. John Roderick irritated him with his habit of calling men she and pretending that everyone from George Washington to John Wayne was a screaming queen. Donald's Arcadia was his ideal of innocence. One of his prized possessions, which he kept with him wherever he lived and would show proudly to his friends, was a collection of photo albums neatly lined up on his bookshelves that contained, like so many pinned-up butterflies, photographs of his sexual conquests going back to the late 1940s. They were of a type, these wide-eyed, handsome country boys, grinning in some steaming hot spring bath, relaxing on the tatami floor of a country inn, playfully flexing muscles in a white T-shirt, or leaning against a truck. Nobuo was a bus driver. Shinichi a builder, Yasuo a baseball coach, and so on. They were all straight, or so Donald liked to believe. My own Japanese immersion did not involve a quest for innocence. I did not grow up in Ohio, haunted by original sin. The pleasure I took in hearing of Donald's escapades was vicarious. Instead, I was knocking on the doors of prominent figures in theater and film, which often sprang open with surprising ease. Famous directors would come and meet me for coffee, even though they probably had a hard time understanding my faulty Japanese. I still wince a little at the thought of Suzuki Tadashi, one of the grandest people in the modern Japanese theater, patiently hearing me gush on about performances I'd seen of his group, the Waseda Shogekijo, at the Mikkari Theater in Amsterdam, and listening to my callow questions about the influence of the kabuki on contemporary drama. Suzuki, the son of a no actor, was an intellectual. He answered in rapid sentences that I could barely follow. Being able to meet such grandees at short notice was part of the gaijin's privilege. There were so few Westerners in Tokyo at that time with an interest in modern Japanese drama or film that one had the advantage of rarity. People like me piqued the curiosity of people who otherwise wouldn't have given us the time of day. Donald Ritchie was a pioneer in this field. Indeed, he had played an important role himself in the Tokyo culture of the 60s, when he made a number of experimental films with music scores by the great Takemitsu Toru. But in this he was pretty much alone. Years later, sometime in the 1980s, I was at a screening in Tokyo of Donald's short films. The event was organized for the benefit of his friend, the American poet James Merrill. Next to me sat Edward Seidensticker, looking professorial in jacket and tie. He had brought a family friend from the States, a very proper-looking young lady in a beige woolen twin set. One of the films was entitled Boy with Cat. A handsome young Japanese boy in white jeans is seen in the moody shadows of a traditional Japanese room with summer noises in the background. The rasp of cicadas. A child practicing Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. While the boy is leafing through a set of heterosexual pornographic pictures, he sticks his hand into his jeans and masturbates. A black cat jumps onto his thigh. The music abruptly stops, signaling the end of the movie. When the lights went on, there was a moment of silence in the screening room. Professor Seidensticker then slowly turned to the young lady on his right and drawled, "That was a very nice cat." Boy with Cat was by no means a great film, but it was a noble experiment, the work of a foreign romantic who'd found his corner of paradise. Donald had none of Oshima's political radicalism. He was too detached for that. Nor did he especially admire Oshima's films, which I think he found didactic. Donald much preferred the movies of Ozu Yasujiro, whose quiet, humanistic fatalism was everything that Oshima's generation rebelled against. And yet, in a profound sense, Ritchie and Oshima were on the same side. Far from producing anything of my own, I was still at the stage of deciphering what I heard and saw. I spent hours trying to make sense of essays by Teruyama Shuji with the help of a dictionary, imagining that my guesswork somehow added something to the mystique of what I was reading. His most famous essay encouraged young people to leave home, move to the city, and love freely. But Teruyama himself lived the wild life mostly in his imagination. The same was true for me. Theater performances were especially hard to crack. One summer night, I saw Karajuro's Jokyo Gekijo Situation Theater perform in a crimson tent pitched on the edge of a large pond in Ueno, the water surface covered in pink lotus flowers. Kara's troupe was another legend of the 60s. Like traveling players in pre-modern Japan, Kara and his actors put up their tent all over Japan at Shinto shrines, between railway tracks, in abandoned car parks, on fairgrounds, and on riverbanks. His plays were surreal collages drawn from Japanese as well as Western sources, sometimes melodramatic, always raucous and full of wild humor, acted in a loud, exaggerated, stylized manner that owed something to the bawdy origins of kabuki and something to the rough-and-ready style of cross-talking comedians. They were as deliberately grotesque as Terayama's spectacles, but earthier, more physical. Actors would suddenly appear drenched from a tank of water, or from a pond behind the tent. A spectacular entrance by one of the main stars would be greeted by wild cheers from the audience pressed together on straw mats. The play I saw on that humid night in 1975, entitled Kaze no Matasaburo, was based on a Japanese fairy tale about a wind sprite appearing from nowhere as a student at a small village school in the rural northeast. Kara combined this with a variation of the Orpheus myth, a mother searching for her long-lost son in the underworld. Songs or zany references to popular movies, manga characters, TV commercials, political scandals, and even snatches of French existentialism alternated with scenes of pure slapstick. I understood virtually nothing, but the effect was similar to what I had experienced at the Mikkeri Theatre in Amsterdam. I was transported into a strange new place, as disturbing as it was seductive, which looked no less strange when the flaps of the red tent opened at the end to reveal the moonlit lotus pond in all its uncanny glory. The state of mystification during my first year in Japan, deciphering words, codes, and signs, and only half understanding them as I wandered through the maze of modern Tokyo, felt strangely akin to the spirit of Kara's plays, with its lost characters trying to connect in a surreal world. I began my story by claiming that I felt no attraction to the exotic, and this was true as far as Zen meditation or some of the finer arts were concerned. But I was fascinated by the outlandish aspects of Japanese culture, the ero guro nonsense, and the erotic, the grotesque, and the absurd continued to intrigue me, even though much of their physical manifestations are more hidden now under ever slicker layers of Japanese modernity. My chief guide into the mysteries of Japanese culture, apart from Donald, my sensei, was a dropout student named Tsuda. A small man with a fringed Beatles haircut, Tsuda was one of those people whose intellectual brilliance took him everywhere and nowhere. Endlessly curious, always ready with an interesting theory, Tsuda was stimulating company. But in conventional terms, he would have to be classified as a failure. He viewed a university education as a waste of time, and competing for a decent job to be beneath his dignity. With just enough family funds to keep him afloat, Tsuda was a flaneur, a dabbler, a dreamer, and above all, a talker. He could talk about anything. Oshima's movies, traditional Japanese architecture, Nietzsche, 19th-century romantic literature, or the decadence of Japanese aesthetics. An extra boon to me was the fact that he couldn't speak a word of English. We first met while standing in line for tickets to see Suzuki Tadashi's theatre company perform a play that mixed Greek drama with a smattering of texts by the mid-19th-century kabuki playwright Tsuruya Namboku. We hit it off, Tsuda and I, because it soon became clear that we were both outsiders in different ways. He had made himself an outsider from the inside, as it were, whereas I was peering in from the outside. We were both voyeurs, really, exploring the proletarian east of the city, hanging around the cheap cafes and bars in Shinjuku, and meeting up with his cronies from Tokyo University who had not dropped out, who had found good jobs, and whom Tsuda regarded with a mixture of pride and disdain, except perhaps for one named Nasu, whom he admired without reservation. After completing a law degree, Nasu had made a successful career at Nikatsu, making Roman porno movies. I never succeeded in making a student film at Nichidai, even though I did acquire an 8mm camera, the standard tool for student productions. Instead, I used the excellent darkroom facilities and concentrated on photography, the perfect art for a voyeur dancing around the fringes. Japan, especially then, was a photographer's dream. Before photography entered the artistic mainstream elsewhere, photographers were celebrated figures in Japan, whose shows at major galleries were mobbed by crowds of enthusiasts. Among the Japanese texts I was trying to decipher were the thick, glossy, deeply serious photography magazines, published by large newspaper companies. Moriyama Daido, who had become world-famous decades later, gave evening classes in a tiny space in Shinjuku, which I sometimes attended, dipping in and out, hovering at the edges. Shinoyama Kishin was taking pictures of tattooed gangsters, fashion models, and a rising young kabuki star named Tama Saburo, who specialized in female roles. The seedy backstreets of U.S. base towns were recorded in grainy black and white by To Matsushome. And then there was Araki. He was everywhere in the 1970s, making the rounds of the tiny bars in Shinjuku or the raunchiest cabarets, giggling and chattering non-stop, as he snapped away at anything that caught his fancy on the seamy side of Tokyo nightlife. Cabaret hostesses cavorting in the nude amid drunken punters in suits, naked girls eating bananas or pissing into plastic umbrellas held up by grinning patrons, women tied up in ropes or being fucked in live sex shows. The wild 70s were sometimes called Showa Genroku, after the hedonistic Genroku period at the end of the 17th century. Showa was the name of Emperor Hirohito's reign, which spanned much of the 20th century. Araki's face, with the tiny round spectacles, the dirty old man's moustache, and the intense little voyeur's eyes, had become one of the icons of Showa Genroku. He was the Toulouse-Lautrec of contemporary Edo Gudo Nansensu. Photographers were doing what woodblock print artists had done in pre-modern Japan, chronicling the floating world of fashion, theater, sex, and urban life. One facet of 60s culture that lingered in the 70s was a fascination for what Japanese call dorokusai, which means stinking of the earth or nostalgie de la boue. The seedy, the obscene, the debauched, the bloody, the smelly, all that permeated the art scene, not just in photography, but in theater, film, literature, manga, and even the graphic arts. It was, I think, a reaction to elite aesthetics, which since the mid-19th century was either rigidly traditionalist or a prissy Japanese version of European high culture. Mishima once wrote in an introduction to a book of photographs of frenzied young men at rowdy Shinto festivals taken by Tex Weatherby's lover Yato Tamotsu that late 19th century Japan had become ashamed of its popular culture, afraid that Westerners would be shocked by its earthiness. Japan, he wrote, tried to deny her past completely, or at least to hide from Western eyes any of the old ways that might resist all efforts to eradicate them. The Japanese were like an anxious housewife preparing to receive guests, hiding away in closets common articles of daily use and laying aside comfortable everyday clothes, hoping to impress the guests with the immaculate, idealized life of her household, without so much as a speck of dust in view. The trend in the 60s, continuing into the 70s, went in the opposite direction. Even though many Japanese of the wartime and early post-war generations had deeply ambivalent feelings about Westerners, the idea was not to eradicate Western influence. That would have been impossible, indeed absurd. But artists like Terayama, Kara, Oshima, Araki, and indeed Mishima wanted to strip Japanese culture of that thick crust of gentility formed over many decades of anxious westernization. My own nostalgie de la boue had less to do with Japanese attitudes towards the West than with my protected background. My immersion in Japan was also partly a flight from bourgeois gentility, even if this flight was superficial, voyeuristic, semi-detached. I photographed the back streets of Shinjuku in the style of Moriyama Daido, who got much of his inspiration from the American William Klein, and I roamed around the still raffish areas flanking the Sumida River in the eastern lowlands, the so-called shitamachi, or low city, as opposed to the high city in the more prosperous hilly areas of the west. My preferred part of Tokyo to wander through and photograph ran from Minamisenju, where a small neglected cemetery under the railway tracks marks the old Edo period execution grounds, through Sanya, the skid row, where labor contractors picked up homeless men for cheap construction jobs every morning, thence on to Yoshiwara, once the elegant red-light district of high-class brothels and tea houses, and now a sordid warren of neon-lit massage parlors, and finally to the temple in Asakusa, dedicated to Kannon, the goddess of mercy. My literary guide on these wanderings was one of my favourite Japanese writers named Nagai Kafu, who died in 1959. His subject was Tokyo, his temperament elegiac. The vulgarity of the present disgusted him. Kafu, he was always known by this sobriquet, could only love in retrospect and celebrate what had disappeared. The westernized city of the late 19th and early 20th century Meiji period moved him deeply, only after it had been largely destroyed by the 1923 earthquake. The brassy modern Tokyo that emerged after that disaster filled him with delight, but only after it was wrecked by B-29 bombers in 1945. Kafu was a mournful archaeologist of the recent past, the tiled wall of a former 1930s brothel in the midst of a crassly modernized post-war neighborhood could move him to tears. There was an old tumble-down theater in Minami-senju, with luridly hand-painted pictures outside of sword-waving warriors and moon-faced geishas. This theater, smelling of fried squid and stale sweat, was home to one of the last troupes of traveling players who performed crude versions of famous kabuki plays about love suicides and noble outlaws. In between acts, the players, after quickly changing into bright Hawaiian shirts, would belt out popular songs through faltering microphones, while others twanged on badly tuned electric guitars. All the female roles were performed by men in the traditional style. One of the actors, a snub-nosed young man with rubbery, rather coarse features, managed in his female guise to look beautiful even in these squalid surroundings. 20 years later, he became a national celebrity, appearing on TV as the Low City Tamasaburo after the famous kabuki actor. I spent many hours in the Minami-senju theatre taking pictures of the actors and of the public whose average age must have been well over 50. The local butcher and his stocky wife, a petty crook or two, roof builders, construction workers and dumpling cooks. God only knows what they thought of the young foreigner snapping away at their feet, but they were always welcoming in a politely amused sort of way. One weekend, I followed the actors on one of their rural tours with Graham, my friend from the Nichidai Library. We stayed the night at a seedy hot spring resort called a green center, where old folks would gather to drink and be entertained by the Low City Tamasaburo and his fellow players. We sat at long wooden tables laden with rice balls, dried squid, pickles, and miso soup, dressed in thin summer kimonos provided by the green center, watching a blood-curdling scene of murder committed by a famous 19th-century brigand, followed by a famous love scene from a creaky samurai drama. All the while I was creeping around taking pictures in the way I'd seen Araki do. But the main entertainment was yet to come. When it was time for a soak in the large communal bath, men and women shed their summer wear and beckoned Graham and me to come in too. The tiled bathroom had the sulphurous stench of rotten eggs. Mount Fuji on the wall was half obscured by steam coming off the scalding hot water. After a quick wash, Graham and I slid gingerly into the bath with all eyes on us. We could not have been more immersed in deepest Japan, I thought, when all of a sudden a burst of cackling laughter creased the wrinkled country faces around us. "Look at those pricks!" one of the oldest ladies in the bath shrieked. "Look at those foreigners' pricks! They're bigger than yours, Granddad!" shouted a stout woman who must have been at least 80. Several shriveled old men smiled sheepishly. "Ooh, Aunt Gaijin White," a third lady exclaimed, as though she had never seen anything so grotesque in her life. "Just like tofu!" Not long after this excursion to the Green Center, I came across another group of entertainers, even lower down the social scale. Tsuda and I had set off on a cold November night during the Torinoichi, or Day of the Rooster. The harvest festival, when for 12 days street markets are laid out near temples and shrines where people pray for a prosperous new year, buy talismanic bamboo rakes decorated with rice and flowers, and eat a special kind of sweet potato said to boost human fertility. This is where the human pump had set up his brown and green striped carnival tent, featuring such curiosities as the snake woman, whose neck appeared to grow all the way to the top of the tent, the girl who bit off the heads of live chickens, and the hairy wolf man. The carnival tent was erected in the same spot where Karajuro's company often pitched their red tent, in front of Hanazono Shrine, dedicated to Inari, the androgynous fox deity of prosperity and worldly success. People craned their necks to see the shrieking young woman hold a chicken in her teeth, her shiny face smeared with blood and feathers and illuminated by a flaming torch. There was a strange, ghostly sound of a whistle as the snake woman's neck got longer and longer, and the wolf man barked at the crowd, which retreated in mock terror. But the main act was the leader of the troupe, the human pump himself. He was an albino male of about 40. The words human pump were written in Japanese phonetic script on his dark sweater. First he would swallow a number of shiny black and white buttons. The public was asked to call out white or black, whereupon the human pump would blink his tiny pale eyes and spit out a button of the requisite color. But his pièce de résistance was the goldfish act. He would swallow a live orange goldfish, and then a yellow one, and shake his head a few times like the fish-eating cormorants I'd seen on a river in western Japan, to let them slide smoothly through his gullet. "Orange!" cried the crowd, and slowly, with intense concentration, the right goldfish would come jetting out of his mouth. These were modest skills, perhaps. Seen from backstage, the trick with the elongated neck became apparent when I noticed the girl's lower body made up of bamboo and papier-mâché. I'm still not sure how the human pump managed to regurgitate the different colored objects on demand. But there was something about the carnival show that mesmerized me, its rawness, its primitive appeal. Here, I thought, was performance reduced to the most basic elements. I realized that this had everything to do with my bourgeois romanticism, my nostalgie de la boue. It was nothing more than a peek into a strange world, a voyeur's glimpse of the forbidden. But I couldn't get enough of it, so I followed the human pump and his family around. The snake woman was his wife, the chicken girl their adopted daughter, and the wolf man was a brother-in-law, I think. Taking pictures backstage, congratulating myself on my brush with a theatrical underworld, the absolute other, as illusory, no doubt, as Donald Ritchie's dreams of innocence, even if I did not realize that yet. Before they left Tokyo to tour other shrines in the provinces, the human pump handed me his name card. "Come and look us up sometime," he said. The address was in a small town not far from Gifu, where the Tani family lived. Unfortunately, I have no photographic record of the most remarkable performance I saw in the summer of 1976. This was not in Tokyo, which had stricter laws about permissible entertainments than other cities, possibly as a result of having to look respectable, like Mishima's prim housewife, for the Tokyo Olympics in 1964. The Toji Deluxe was in Kyoto, behind the main railway station, near the old designated area for outcasts or budakumin, who did ritually unclean work connected with death, such as butchering, tanning, meatpacking, or in the olden days, executing prisoners. The Toji's flashing neon lights were the only bright spot in an otherwise dark street. In the middle of a huge barn-like space was a round, slowly revolving stage, with men sitting in rows waiting for the action to start. Tsuda and I were in the second row. Precisely on time, the theater went dark, and a soft pink light suffused the stage. A young man in a shiny electric blue suit and purple bow tie appeared with a chrome microphone and loudly welcomed us to the show, his words echoing spookily through the theater. The performers were introduced by name as they shuffled onto the stage carrying plastic picnic hampers neatly covered in bits of cloth with pictures of various cartoon characters, Snoopy and the like. I saw one of them hand a baby to one of the stagehands as she made her entrance. Frank Sinatra's Strangers in the Night issued forth from the scratchy sound system. The girls, dressed in negligees, made a bow and simpered in unison what a pleasure it was to entertain us honorable guests tonight. They crouched down, removed the cloth from their baskets, and carefully laid out various props on the edge of the stage. Vibrators of different sizes in pink, yellow, and violet, as well as cucumbers and condoms wrapped in colored cellophane packages. Everything was done with the utmost decorum, the props placed in neat little rows, Strangers in the Night still playing. They stood up and adopted a number of suggestive poses, their faces as mask-like as no dancers or bunlaku puppets. The men in the audience were a mixture of old and young, some dressed in suits and ties, as though coming straight from the office, some dressed like students, a few of them with sports bags. Some of the older men wore the uniforms of Japanese workers, wide khaki trousers, thick woolen waistbands, black splay-toed canvas shoes. On the revolving stage, a few of the girls broke into friendly smiles and slowly made their way to the edge, where the condoms and other props were laid out. One or two picked up a dildo or a cucumber and entered several transparent square boxes that were cranked up a little noisily over our heads. An old-fashioned Japanese ballad began to play on the sound system, something about a lonely mother waiting for her son to come back from abroad. Tsuda whispered in my ear that it was a wartime song. "Now watch closely," said Tsuda, who was an old hand at these things. One by one, the girls on stage moved to the edge and beckoned men in the audience to come forward and join them. Meanwhile, above us, in the transparent buckets, girls were busy inserting cucumbers and dildos into their vaginas. The men giggled and dared one another to climb up. A thin man in a business suit was pushed forward by his friends, but he refused to go, blushing furiously and scratching the back of his neck, the common Japanese gesture for embarrassment. Finally, one of the students in sneakers and training pants went up. He stood up straight like a soldier on parade, staring blankly ahead, while a girl, smiling sweetly, took off all his clothes except for a pair of white sports socks. She expertly slipped on a condom and lay down invitingly. "The doors of paradise are about to open, gentlemen," said the MC in the purple bow tie. Shouts of encouragement came from the audience. The young man, without looking at the girl, began to make vigorous movements with his hips. Alas, the tension must have got to him. Tsuda told me that students often save up for these occasions, sex being relatively unavailable to them otherwise. The young man began to sweat. The girl made soft cooing noises, telling him it would be okay. But after a last, hopeless shake of his hips, the young man gave up. Older men in the audience chortled at the boy's failure. The girl patted his back as he scrambled off the stage, still in his white socks, with his trousers pulled halfway up his thighs. "So was this it?" I asked my friend. He motioned with the palm of his hand in a calming gesture. "Just wait and see." The MC made another announcement through his mic. "Honored guests, the time has come for the tokudashi." "The tokudashi?" I asked Tsuda. "Just wait." The MC, breathing heavily into his mic, said in English, "Open." The men in the audience, as though waiting for this climactic moment, moved forward, wide-eyed, as three women, sitting at the very edge of the stage, leaned back on their elbows and very slowly opened their legs, exposing themselves to the prying gaze of the fascinated audience. The MC handed out some magnifying glasses and small hand torches. "Please share them around so everyone can have a proper look," he said. There was a deadly hush in the theater. No chortling or cackling now as the women moved sideways like crabs from man to man, each taking his turn to peer into the female mystery with the help of torch and magnifying glass. The women encouraged the men to take their time. I was riveted by the spectacle, no less than I had been when I first saw Terayama's theater or Kara's play in the Red Tent. Here was a world that was both deeply strange and utterly human, like some primitive ritual. After it was all over, Tsuda and I had a drink in a tiny bar near the station. He had a theory about the spectacle we'd just witnessed. Japan, he explained, still had vestiges of an ancient matriarchy. In Shinto, he continued, the sun is venerated as a mother goddess named Amaterasu. One day, according to the legend, the sun goddess retreated into a cave in a fit of anger. The world was cast in darkness and evil spirits roamed. The other gods, worried about this state of affairs, tried to coax her out. But Amaterasu stubbornly refused. They tried every trick. Roosters were made to crow, pretending it was dawn. A tree covered in jewels in a bronze mirror was placed in front of the cave. Still she didn't stir. Then the goddess of mirth and revelry named Amano Utsume began to dance wildly on top of a wooden tub, stamping her feet and lifting her dress to show off her private parts, whereupon the gods burst out laughing. The sun goddess could no longer contain her curiosity, peeked out of her hiding place, and was so taken by her own reflection in the mirror on the tree that the gods were able to drag her out, so light came into the world once more. This Tsuda told me and much more, before we parted ways at Kyoto Station. Tsuda to go back to Tokyo, and me to the small town not too far away where I was hoping to visit the human pump and his family. I don't know what I imagined their daily life to be like, a kind of carnival, perhaps, living in a romantic wooden shack or even a tent with other carnies and geeks. I could picture them practicing swallowing swords and goldfish or crying like wolves. Since Japanese addresses follow no logic, I had some difficulty finding their house, but I did in the end. It was an ordinary modern house with a blue-tiled roof, like millions of others, on a rather dreary suburban street. The human pump, dressed in khaki trousers and a plaid shirt, welcomed me in and offered tea and sweet rice cakes. We made small talk about the weather, the difficulty of recent tax hikes, and the bother of travelling. The television was on all the while, with the sound turned down. Wolfman, without his costume, was a rather taciturn figure in a thick grey sweater. The snake woman kept offering me more cakes until I really couldn't manage any more. And the chicken-eating girl asked me about Alain Delon, whom she adored, as did millions of other young Japanese women, assuming, perhaps, that as a fellow gaijin I would have special knowledge of her idol. They couldn't have been nicer. Yet I couldn't help feeling a little deflated. The mystery had gone. There was no absolute other. I had not penetrated the murky depths of some secret world. My romance had been punctured a little. So was my immersion an illusion? Not entirely. It was our common humanity, after all, that had attracted me to Japanese films when I first saw them in Europe. And common humanity is what I found in the middle-class household of the albino goldfish swallower. As with so many ordinary families, the placid surface may have hidden all kinds of secret strangeness. If so, I didn't see it here. My illusion was to suppose that strangeness lies on the surface. But then it was Donald, my sensei, who often impressed me with the notion that the Japanese never assume hidden depths. They take the surface seriously, he would say. The package is the substance. That is at the heart of their sense of beauty. Perhaps he was right. Surfaces matter. One of the things I tried to imitate in Japan was the style of dress of people I thought looked cool. There was a fashion among young people in the 70s to wear traditional wooden Japanese sandals or geta, especially in the summer. Geta are meant to be worn with a kimono, but young men sported them with jeans. They're made of a wooden block with a thong made of cloth. A few really hip young men would wear the more dandyish high geta, normally worn by fishmongers and others who need to rise above wet and slippery floors. The taka geta had super high heels, making it look as if the wearer were walking on low stilts. I wore taka geta, of course, tottering around the narrow shopping streets of Tokyo with a loud, satisfying clip-clop of wood on tarmac, feeling very Japanese. This was part of my immersion. Until one day, on a visit to my relative's mansion in Aobadai, where I'd stayed during my first month in Tokyo, I clip-clopped my way to the gate of his house. There were quite a few people in the street, including some of my relative's staff who had instructed me on Japanese ways. Suddenly, with a hideous crack of shattering wood, I felt my footwear give way, and there I was, with one geta still on, limping to the door. Nobody laughed. They were much too polite for that. In fact, everyone pretended not to have seen a thing. Chapter 4. For Donald Ritchie, growing up in Lima, Ohio, must have been a torment. The small industrial Midwestern town, where the influence of the KKK still lingered, was no place for an artistic young gay boy, hungry for adventure. His only escape was the Sigma movie theater, where a wider world opened up to him. He once wrote that Norma Shearer and Johnny Weissmuller felt more like parents than his real ones. In his words, "In the dusty dark of the Sigma, I was content. At home, more than I ever was at home." Terayama Shuji grew up in the remote northeast of Japan, the thick accent of which he retained, indeed perhaps cultivated, even after years of living in Tokyo. His father had died as a soldier in the war. His mother was usually away, working in a bar at a U.S. military base. Relatives took care of him. They owned a cinema. It was there, doing his homework behind the film screen, that Terayama grew up, hearing the same ghostly voices as Richie in Ohio. That dream palace, smelling of piss, was a recurring theme in Terayama's poems and plays. His fantasies had fed my fantasies. His was the circus that I followed out of my native country. Donald's great escape came at the end of the war, when he joined the Merchant Navy. His favorite book at the time was a Baroque travel account entitled The Asiatics by Frederick Prokosh. It described the travels of a young man from Beirut to China. Since Prokosh had never been anywhere east of Berlin, the book was an invention made up by the author from guidebooks and travel stories. Donald actually met Prokosh in 1945 or 1946. His Merchant Navy ship was moored in Naples, where Prokosh happened to be spending the winter. The writer, dressed in an elegant cream-colored suit, eyed the ship's crew and selected some of the more fetching sailors for an evening on the town. Donald was one of them. Prokosh took a shine to him and wanted to know all about his rough life at sea. Donald answered by declaring how much he admired Prokosh's writing, whereupon the great man of letters rolled his eyes and turned away in disgust. Donald left the Merchant Marine and applied for a job in Japan, which he got because of his peculiar talent for typing at great speed. Arriving in Tokyo in 1947, he began writing for the Stars and Stripes military newspaper. Japan was still under U.S. occupation. There were strict rules against fraternizing with the indigenous personnel. Nightclubs, bars, cinemas, coffee shops, even the Kabuki Theater were off-limits. Anyone caught sneaking into these indigenous spots could be sent back home in disgrace. Donald took the risk. He couldn't imagine living without the movies, and he wanted to be where the natives were. One of his preferred haunts was the old Rokuza Theater, which still stood in the ruins of Asakusa in the midst of hastily rebuilt striptease parlors, all-girl operas, and burlesque houses. There he was, in his words, wedged at the back, smelling the rice odor sweat of the people back then, mixed with the fragrance of the camellia oil pomade the men used to use on their hair, and beyond these, the beloved odor of the vast, cold, dusty, expectant emptiness in the back of the screen. And then the lights went down. The movies for Donald were perhaps not a substitute for life, as they had been in Ohio, but they offered a glimpse into an entirely Japanese world. He couldn't understand a word of what was being said on the screen, but this, he believed, was partly to his advantage. It forced him to pay more attention to what he was taking in with his eyes. If he couldn't follow the stories, he could at least try to make sense of how they were told. He noticed the lack of close-up shots compared with Hollywood movies, and he observed the body language of the character seen in the middle distance. He was struck by the use of space in the way shots were composed, leaving much to the imagination, a bit like traditional Chinese-style paintings. 30-odd years later, the smell of rice and camellia pomade had gone. But many of the old movie houses in Asakusa and other parts of Tokyo were still there. Some were hidden in back alleys, some in underground shopping arcades, and some on the top floors of department stores. Tokyo in the 1970s was one of the world's great cinema cities, its offerings as varied as in New York or even Paris. There were dozens of art cinemas featuring new movies or retrospectives of Antonioni, Oshima, or Fellini. The latest Hollywood films, as well as commercial Japanese films, were shown in hundreds of cinemas scattered all over town. And then there were the seedier venues, offering all-night showings of Japanese gangster pictures, Roman porno, or samurai epics in a haze of stale cigarette smoke. My own attraction to the reek of mud drew me to the Yakuza all-nighters, starring Takakura Ken or Tsuruta Koji.